From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukrainian politics taking a turn, countering the Islamic State militants. Turmoil in Libya, plus another healthcare worker dies of Ebola in West Africa. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko went on national television Monday to make a special announcement.
Дорогі співвітчизники, я вирішив достроково припинити.
Mr. Poroshenko said he was dissolving parliament and calling for early elections. He said voting for a new parliament will be held on October the 26th. This comes 1 month after his ruling coalition government collapsed. Mr. Poroshenko said last week that any decision regarding parliament would be guided by what the Ukrainian people want. He said they're demanding what he called a reboot of power. And in Moscow on Monday, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov spoke to reporters about sending another Russian aid convoy into rebel-held eastern Ukraine. In sending the first convoy last Friday, Russia said it had lost patience with what it called Ukraine's stalling tactics. The convoy was denounced by the Ukrainian government as an invasion and condemned by the United States, the European Union, and NATO. Mr. Lavrov said that food, water, and other goods delivered to the hard-hit rebel-held city of Lugansk was by the first convoy was being distributed on Monday with the participation of the International Committee of the Red Cross. There was no immediate confirmation of that by the Red Cross.
Ми готові працювати в будь-якому составі.
The Russian foreign minister also said his government was ready to help Ukrainians agree upon the parameters which are necessary for them to live in one state. The Ukrainian government in the past few weeks has been making strong gains, taking back territory from the rebels. It believed that the aid convoy was a ploy by Russia to get supplies to the rebels and slow down government advances. The 28 NATO members are preparing for their summit meeting in Wales in early September. VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshra looks at the main issue that they'll be discussing, the notion of collective defense in light of Russia's recent actions against Ukraine.
Simply put, NATO's collective defense posture means that an attack on one of its 28 members is an attack on all of them. In a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said the alliance must remain ready, willing, and able to defend its almost 1 billion citizens. Rasmussen went on to say NATO leaders must take steps to make the alliance fitter, faster, and more flexible to address future challenges from wherever they come. NATO's collective defense doctrine is in the spotlight, given Russia's recent actions against Ukraine, its annexation of the Crimean Peninsula, and its backing of Russian separatists in the eastern part of the country. Retired Admiral James Stavridis, former Supreme Allied Commander at NATO, says Russian President Vladimir Putin's aggressive behavior will backfire.
President Putin's strategy, I think, is going to be a strategic failure. In effect, it is strengthening NATO, it is instilling more resolve in the alliance, and will create even more cohesion than was the case before the events in Ukraine.
Russia's behavior has also instilled apprehension and even fear in some countries, such as the Baltic states, that Moscow might try to invade a NATO country. Sean Kay, a NATO expert at Ohio Wesleyan University, assesses the balance of forces.
In terms of defending the NATO allies against Russia, I mean, the NATO allies have an overwhelming military advantage in terms of their combined capabilities. The structure of power singularly is in the hands of the West. So it's a question of how they want to best leverage the future relationship with Russia, given its recent behavior.
Stavridis puts it this way.
I don't stay up at night worrying about Russia's ability to invade a NATO nation.
But to allay the fears of those countries who feel threatened by Russia's behavior, Stavridis says at the NATO summit, leaders must take firm action.
There should be an enhanced number of aircraft patrolling the borders of the alliance. We should have larger and more robust maritime deployments, both north in the Baltic and south in the Black Sea. We should, in my view, support the Ukrainian armed forces with equipment, training, cyber support, advice, and help them prepare in case Russia takes the next step, which would be an overt invasion of Ukraine.
Looking ahead, Stavridis sees increased tension between NATO and Russia, but not a return to a Cold War era.
During the Cold War, 6 million people faced off against each other across the Fulda Gap. Huge navies patrolled the world and were on a hair trigger alert. We had nuclear weapons cocked, aimed, loaded, and ready to fire. There were proxy wars around the world. It was the dominant political and military activity of 20 to 30 years. No, we're not headed back to that.
The former senior NATO commander says the upcoming NATO summit will also discuss the alliance's role in Afghanistan after more than 10 years of engagement, and how to apportion defense spending more equitably among its members. Andre Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Here in the U.S., President Obama has not yet made a decision to pursue military options in Syria against Islamic State militants. White House spokesman Josh Earnest Monday said that while the U.S. is serious about confronting the Islamic State threat, military force is not the only component of the U.S. strategy in confronting the extremists, often referred to as ISIL.
It also includes working closely with an effective, inclusive Iraqi government that can unite that country to meet the threat. It also includes greater engagement with the Iraqi military to improve training and, if necessary, improving and increasing the supply of equipment that they have access to. It also includes engaging Sunni tribes in western Iraq. These are areas where these tribes have significant influence. These are also happen to be the areas where ISIL has made the most significant gains. So there's an opportunity for us to leverage their support to try to confront this threat. There also is the likelihood or the ability of the United States, using our diplomatic abilities and relationships, to leverage the involvement of other countries in the region and other countries around the world to work with the Iraqis to confront the threat that's posed by ISIL.
When asked by reporters about the potential of an Islamic State attack inside the United States, Earnest said there is no evidence of an active plot underway by the militants against the U.S. homeland. The White House says no ransom was paid to Islamic extremists to free kidnapped U.S. journalist Peter Theo Curtis. While the exact conditions of Curtis's release are still unclear, White House spokesman Earnest said Monday U.S. officials put the Curtis family in touch with people and authorities in Qatar who dealt with the Nusra Front, the group holding him for nearly 2 years. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Curtis's release on Sunday came after about 5 days after a video posted on the Internet showing the beheading of American journalist James Foley at the hands of an Islamic State militant.
Curtis was handed over to UN peacekeepers at a village in the Golan Heights late Sunday and delivered to American representatives. U.S. officials say he is now out of Syria and will be reunited with his family soon. Jonathan Edelman, associate professor at the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, says there are a couple of ways the Curtis release is tied to the August 19th video of Foley's execution.
One is that al-Nusra, which is really more of a Syrian group than a kind of caliphate, you know, international group, clearly wanted to demonstrate that even though they've killed and tortured people before, that they're not like ISIS. They're kind of trying to differentiate themselves. Secondly, for Qatar, that's very important because they just suffered in the Israeli-Hamas war a major setback several weeks ago when they and Turkey guaranteed a ceasefire and that they were going to be able to, quote, deliver Hamas for the ceasefire, and they failed.
Middle East analyst Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco says the Curtis release may also be an attempt by al-Nusra to forestall any potential expansion of U.S. airstrikes to Syria from northern Iraq.
There is some suspicion that United States and perhaps other countries will take their battle against ISIS that we've already seen develop in Iraq across the Syrian border. And I think the al-Nusra folks are trying to make it clear they are a separate grouping and don't want to be on the receiving end of such a military retaliation.
The Curtis family says the journalist was captured shortly after crossing into Syria in October 2012. Details of his release are unclear, but Curtis's mother, Nancy, said the family was repeatedly told by representatives of the Guntari government that they were mediating for Theo's release on a humanitarian basis without the payment of money. She said her Cambridge, Massachusetts family is eternally grateful to all those who helped negotiate his release. The White House says President Barack Obama shares the joy and relief now that Theo is out of Syria and safe. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, in a statement, said the United States reached out to more than two dozen countries, asking for urgent help from anyone who might have tools, influence, or leverage to help secure the journalist's release and that of any other Americans held hostage in Syria. The Committee to Protect Journalists said Syria is the most dangerous country in the world for journalists. At least 70 have been killed in the past 2 years. More than 80 have been kidnapped, and about 20 are currently missing in Syria. British Prime Minister David Cameron said last week it is increasingly likely the masked executioner of journalist James Foley was a British national. Appearing on U.S. television Sunday, Britain's ambassador to the United States, Peter Westmacott, indicated intelligence agencies are close to identifying Foley's executioner.
I've been in touch, obviously, the last day or two with my colleagues at home. We're not yet in a position to say exactly who this is, but there is some very sophisticated voice identification technology and other measures that we have got, which should allow us to be very clear about who this person is before very long.
Westmacott says there may be as many as 500 people from the United Kingdom who have gone to join the IS jihadists. Memorial services for Foley were held Sunday in Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan and his hometown of Rochester, New Hampshire. Members of the Kurdistan Journalist Syndicate, university students, lawmakers, and diplomats, including the U.S. Consul General in Erbil, Joseph Pennington, were on hand for the service in Iraq.
James Foley went to the darkest of places to shine the light of truth. Today, our thoughts, our prayers go out to James Foley's family, friends, and colleagues who are grieving his loss.
The memorial mass at the Our Lady of the Holy Rosary Church in New Hampshire was attended by Foley's parents and hundreds of others, and led by Bishop Peter Lebosky.
Indeed, since this moment in our lives is international in scope, crossing all boundaries, yet very personal, bound together by a deep sense of human compassion and heartfelt remorse, I wish to extend to you, in the name of all people of goodwill, our deepest sympathy, our continued prayer, and our pledge to keep the witness of James's life as a personal call to faith, courage, and love.
The bishop also read aloud a letter from Pope Francis extending his condolences. A funeral for Foley is expected to be held October 18th on what would have been his 41st birthday. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Fighting raged in Gaza again on Monday, even as Egypt pressured Israel and the Palestinians to agree to a new ceasefire that could last at least a month. Israeli airstrikes killed 8 people more in Gaza on the 49th day of the conflict. Israeli army said Hamas militants fired 80 rockets across the border into Israel, but there were no casualties. Meanwhile, Egypt pressed the warring sides to stop fighting and resume negotiations to forge an enduring truce in Gaza. Gaza conflict that erupted on July the 8th has killed more than 2,100 Palestinians, most of them civilian, including 500 children. 64 Israeli soldiers and 4 civilians have been killed. Libya's political and military conflict heated up on Monday after the Islamist coalition, which controls the capital Tripoli, appointed a new prime minister and declared the newly elected parliament null and void. The prime minister already in office, Abdullah Avani, responded by calling the Islamist forces in Tripoli tyrants and insisting they could not govern the country by force. Edward Uranian is following the story.
Libya's rival political forces threw down the gauntlet at each other Monday as their political and military feud intensified. Newly reappointed Prime Minister Abdullah Thani told journalists in the eastern Libyan city of Tobruk that the Islamist Fajr militia, which captured the capital's airport on Saturday, is trying to impose its will by force and that its political moves are illegal.
نقف ضد من يحاول التشكيك بوحدة الوطن
He says he opposes anyone who tries to divide the country, and the attempt by Nuri Boussahmane, Speaker of the old General National Congress, to appoint a new government is null and void, since Boussahmane is now an ordinary citizen with no authority to appoint anyone. Mr. Thani added that any meeting of the former assembly is illegitimate. He said Libya's new parliament, elected in June, is the only body with the authority to appoint and that all Libyans should unite around it. Mr. Thani accused the Fajr militia of behaving in a dictatorial manner reminiscent of the late ousted strongman Muammar Gaddafi. The government, he insisted, could no longer operate in Tripoli due to insecurity, and he blasted Fajr militiamen for allegedly setting fire to his home and office. Earlier, pro-Islamist political leader Omar Homaidan gave a press conference in Tripoli declaring the replacement of Mr. Thani. He said Abdullah Thani has been removed from his positions as, in his words, caretaker prime minister and defense minister, and that Omar Suleiman Saleh al-Khassi has been appointed to form a new national government in the next week after taking the oath of office before National Congress Speaker Nuri Boussahmane. Boussahmane, an Islamist, has locked horns repeatedly with liberal political leaders, including Libya's former prime minister, Ali Zaidan. Boussahmane led the move to oust Mr. Zaidan last March. Meanwhile, in Cairo, Libya's neighbors met to discuss the conflict and called for national dialogue to end Libya's violence. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry said the regional grouping had agreed to oppose any sort of outside intervention. He said the parties had agreed to respect Libya's unity and sovereignty and to refuse any outside interference in the country's internal affairs, promoting national dialogue to solve the ongoing conflict and to put an immediate stop to all armed violence. Libyan TV, which is now controlled by the Islamist forces in Tripoli, announced that outgoing army head Abdel Salam Jaballah al-Obeidi, who was removed over the weekend by the Libyan parliament in Tobruk, would remain in office. The station also claimed that Libya's judiciary had agreed to the reinstatement of the old General National Congress due to what the TV report called the current political void. The GNC's official mandate expired last February. The new parliament was elected in June and began to meet last month. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
A Liberian doctor who received one of the last known doses of an experimental Ebola drug has died. Dr. Abraham Bodor, the deputy chief medical doctor at Liberia's largest hospital, had received ZMAP. Dr. Masakoi, who helped administer the drug to Dr. Bodor, spoke to a reporter on Monday.
Did he take the ZMAP?
Yeah, he finished the full course.
But then what went wrong?
Well, he also has some comorbidities.
What's that?
I mean, he had other problems other than just Ebola.
Ebola. But did he recover from Ebola?
That I don't know. That's why we are doing the test to know his test result. The sample was taken yesterday and we want to know whether.
How many persons took it?
Three people.
Namely?
I can't name them. Three health workers, two doctors, one nurse.
Health experts caution that ZMAP has never been tested in humans before, and it's unclear whether it works. The drug was also given to two Americans who survived after they received medical care here in the U.S. A Spanish missionary priest infected with Ebola also received the treatment but died. There was no update given on the two other Liberians who took the last known available doses of ZMapp. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, have begun airlifting emergency supplies to Liberia, the country hardest hit by the West Africa Ebola epidemic. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
UNICEF's representative in Liberia, Sheldon Yetz, says the supplies are needed to bolster protection against the Ebola virus.
The largest component of the supplies was chlorine, and chlorine is a key ingredient here used for disinfection, which, as you might imagine, in the circumstances in Liberia, is needed in all health centers and is needed in Ebola treatment centers.
The shipment included 27 metric tons of chlorine in all.
We also had ORS, oral rehydration salts. We also had sodium lactate, which is also used to help ensure people are rehydrated. And we had about 900,000 gloves, which, of course, is also very important for infection control. The shipment also includes ready-to-use therapeutic food, which is helpful for patients who are undergoing treatment, and other basic supplies.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, helped to pay for the first flight. Also, the agency's Ebola Disaster Assistance Response Team is helping with delivery. Yet says another plane load of supplies is expected in Monrovia Tuesday. The second flight is supported by the Liberian government and World Bank.
UNICEF is supporting the efforts, making the arrangements, and ensuring the supplies are purchased at the most competitive cost. But this is a government-driven airlift.
The second flight will bring more chlorine and emergency supplies to protect health workers and civilians alike.
Health workers have suffered a disproportionate number of the casualties from Ebola. We need to make sure that health centers are disinfected, that the health centers are safe, and that people in Liberia feel free and safe to return to health centers. There are many, many other diseases, of course, that are endemic here. Cholera is here, malaria is here, and many common diseases. We don't want people dying from preventable diseases because they don't feel safe to use health services.
More airlifts will be carried out in the coming weeks to Liberia, but Yet says despite the airlifts, a lot more personnel and supplies are needed.
We really need more boots on the ground. We need more support from our technical partners, and we need more resources. I've been in emergencies all around the world, and I've been struck at how slow resources have been in coming here. We need additional support, not just financial support, but also technical capacity. We work hand in hand with our NGO partners all around the world. We need them to come here to Liberia, too.
Yet says the Ebola outbreak has generated a lot of fear, but he says medical workers can safely work in the country. He says UNICEF is taking a leading role in a multimedia awareness campaign in Liberia.
We've got teams going door to door in the most affected counties of the country. We've got radio campaigns going on in various languages. We've got pop songs on the radio giving the message. We've got one-minute plays that are being produced. So we're using every avenue we can to make sure people understand what they can do to keep themselves safe from Ebola and what they can do to stop the spread of the disease.
UNICEF is also providing motorcycles so community health workers can travel to many Liberian communities. More than 600 people have died of Ebola in Liberia. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And in all, Ebola has killed more than 1,400 people across West Africa. Family members, dignitaries, and mourners filled a church Monday in the U.S. city of St. Louis, Missouri, to honor the memory of Michael Brown. He's the unarmed African-American teenager shot and killed by a white police officer. Many demonstrators who have kept steady vigils in Ferguson, where the August 9th incident occurred, honored a request from Brown's family to make the day peaceful. Many of them have been complaining that police response to their demonstrations has been heavy-handed. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers, Zarat Abuzaid and Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On August 26, 1346, the Battle of Crécy took place in northern France. It was one of the most important battles of the Hundred Years' War, establishing the battle supremacy of the English longbow over the French combination of crossbows and armored knights. In 1920, the United States formally adopted the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which guaranteed women the right to vote. The amendment was the culmination of more than 70 years of struggle by activists whose protests finally bore fruit. In 1970, another activist, author Betty Friedan, chose the 50th anniversary of the 19th Amendment to lead 20,000 protesters in New York, saying that the promise of women's equality had not been achieved. On this date in 1743, Antoine Lavoisier was born. Recognized as the father of modern chemistry, Lavoisier gave names to oxygen and hydrogen and devised one of the first lists of elements. In 1873, the man who called himself the father of radio, Lee DeForest, was born. The American inventor won more than 300 patents during his lifetime, but is best known for inventing the Audion, a vacuum tube used in electronic amplification. In 1909, Swiss paleontologist Otto Hauser discovered an almost perfectly preserved Cro-Magnon skeleton while hunting for fossils in France. Cro-Magnon people were early humans who lived during the Ice Age in Europe. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
International conventions prohibit child marriage and define 18 as the age of adulthood because children and adolescents are not mature enough to make choices about marriage. In fact, child marriage is a human rights violation and one that disproportionately affects poor girls. Yet every year, an estimated 14 million girls under age 18 are married worldwide with little or no say in the matter. Early marriage harms both the girls and their children. Adolescent girls and others as young as 8 are a long way from being ready to become wives and mothers. Girls who marry early often quit school. Too frequently, they become pregnant before their bodies are fully developed, and thus they run a high risk of dying as a direct result of pregnancy or childbirth. Worldwide, girls aged 15 to 19 account for 70,000 such deaths each year. In developing countries, the infants of mothers under the age of 18 have a 60% higher risk of dying in their first year of life than do infants born to mothers older than 19. Such children are more likely to suffer from low birth weight, undernutrition, and late physical and cognitive development. They are also less likely to go to school and to achieve higher levels of education. And because child marriage stunts girls' educational opportunities and income-earning prospects, it perpetuates poverty in their communities. Thus, because delaying the age of marriage not only benefits the girls themselves, but their families and communities. The United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, committed an additional $4.8 million to fund programs in Bangladesh, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, India, Nepal, Tanzania, and Yemen to end child early and forced marriage. These programs, which will focus on education, advocacy for child marriage legislation, and enforcement and economic incentives, are yet another facet of U.S. support for the advancement of women and girls. Ending child marriage will not only remove a major barrier to global progress, but also help ensure a world where girls can look forward to growing up, said USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah. Together, we can build a future in which all children have the opportunity to reach their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.